Can you imagine what this family was going through at this time? And as we know, what they didn't know then was that this conflict was not going to be resolved for decades. Family torn apart because of deceit and conflict. None of us really like conflict, right? And yet, it is an inevitable part of our lives, whether it's with our spouse or our children or our brothers and sisters or friends or co-workers or bosses or church members. We cannot avoid conflict. And what about unresolved conflict? What happens when we decide that it's not worth working through? Earlier this week at our church council meeting, Arliss shared with us a devotional from Pastor Rick Warren in which he listed these three consequences of holding on to conflict too long. First, that unresolved conflict blocks our fellowship with God. Second, that unresolved conflict hinders our prayers. And third, that unresolved conflict hinders our happiness. And we can certainly see that through the characters of Jacob and Isaac and Rebekah and Esau. As Christians, though, we aren't called to eliminate conflict. That's just simply unrealistic. It's not going to happen until Jesus calls again or comes again. Rather, we are called to work through conflict in a way that honors the name of Christ. And yet, if the way in which the world and Christians even are responding to conflict in our nation, in our state, in our churches, with one another, if the ways that we do that are indicative of anything, we aren't any better at conflict resolution than non-Christians. And in fact, we might be a little bit worse because we claim to follow a God who has taught us to bring peace, and yet we bring something else. Martin Luther King Jr. said that man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. This morning we're going to talk about such a method, and it is all encapsulated in this word reconciliation, which Dick introduced to us last week. The Apostle Paul calls us ambassadors of reconciliation, meaning that we are representatives of God's kingdom work here on earth to a world at war. And so what does it mean then for us to be ambassadors? Well, we're going to look at this story of Jacob and Esau and the conflict that ripped their family apart as a model for understanding different roles in conflict, as a model for understanding the way we approach conflict resolution, and then finally as a model of a journey towards reconciliation. First, let's consider the characters and the roles in which they played in the conflict and what roles we play in conflicts. First, let's think about Esau. Esau was the victim. And he really was. Twice he was deceived by his brother Jacob out of the two major inheritances that he would have received from his father, the birthright and the blessing. And now he would receive nothing. In fact, Isaac cursed him, which I'm not really sure as I read and think about this if that was necessary, but that's what happened. Now, Esau really, even though he kind of played it up as it was not an innocent victim, which we're going to talk about later. And Jacob was prophesied to rule over his brother by God to his mother Rebekah, but I don't believe it was God's intention to use deception as a means of making this happen. Secondly, so we have Esau the victim. Secondly, we have Jacob, the main antagonist. Jacob was the main party that stole the birthright and blessing. And although Rebekah certainly encouraged this to happen, he can't blame her for everything. The reality is we have to take responsibility for our actions. And he ultimately went ahead with the plans that would lead towards the conflict. Third, we have Rebekah, was kind of the assistant or the encourager, the plotter. She was not the main antagonist, but she definitely played a major role in the conflict itself. Throughout Jacob's life, the younger, favoring him, encouraging him, reminding him that God was going to bless him. And then coming up with that brilliant idea of using the goat skin to trick her own husband. She might have thought she was doing the right thing, but ultimately what she did led to more conflict and more problems. And then finally we have Isaac, who at this moment was really the unwitting participant. It was his blessing that sent this whole situation over the tipping point. But because of the fact that he was blind, that he couldn't get out of bed, that he may have even been senile, he participated in the conflict, but really had no idea that he was doing so. So we have victim, antagonist, assistant, unwitting participant. And these certainly aren't the only roles that we'll see in conflict, but things that I would guess we could all relate to. In fact, I would bet that all of us have played one of these roles, maybe all of these roles, at different parts in our lives, whether or not we're going to admit it. So, through the characters, we see the different roles in conflict. What do we see about conflict resolution from them? How do they approach it? And how does it maybe relate to the ways in which we approach conflict resolution? Well, let's first look at Esau. Esau was reactionary. I mean, immediately wailing and then threatening to murder Jacob. He wanted to take care of it now, and he wanted justice. I'm sure some of us can relate to this, this immediacy, this reactiveness, maybe even some of the anger and explosiveness. Then you have Jacob, who's a little weaselly, and he goes straight for the Mennonite favorite, avoidance and running away, which was legitimate because his life was threatened, but he ran away nonetheless. Rebekah encourages him to flee to her brother Laban, and she believed he was only going to be there maybe a couple months, maybe till Esau calmed down, as if, and as I was reading this, I was thinking she really treated it as if it was no big deal. What she didn't know was that it would be over 20 years before the brothers would meet again. So we have these two approaches to conflict resolution very common. That is that immediate explosive response and then avoidance. And we've seen the various roles that we can play in conflict. The victim or the antagonist or the encourager or the unwitting participant. So the question now that we have to turn to is, what would God have us learn about reconciliation from this passage? Not about avoidance, not about reaction, but reconciliation. John Paul Lederach, from whom I'm taking a lot of my message or using a lot of my message from this morning, in his book Reconcile, wrote a chapter on Jacob and Esau, and he wrote this, that reconciliation is a journey, an encounter, and a place. That's what we're going to be talking about here for a few moments. A journey, an encounter, and a place. God calls us to set out on this journey through conflict, marked by places where we will see the face of God, the face of the enemy, and the face of our own selves. So let's take a closer look at this story and discover for ourselves what true Christian reconciliation looks like through journey, encounter, and place. First, reconciliation as a journey. Lederach says that it's a journey both to conflict and through conflict. So let's consider the to conflict. Right? Because no conflict comes out of nowhere. There's always these precipitating events. And there was certainly that in the lives of Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Rebekah. Let's consider some of the things that led to this conflict. First, there was a prophecy. Rebekah and Jacob, their story was very similar to Isaac and Sarah. And if you remember, Isaac and Sarah were barren and had children way late in life. The same thing happened with Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca. So the parents were barren and had children later in life. Same thing for Isaac and Rebecca. And Isaac pleads to God on Rebecca's behalf for children, and she becomes pregnant with twins. But something's wrong. They're fighting and they're wrestling in the womb. And so Rebecca goes before God and says, God, what is happening? And this is how God replies. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body, and one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Right then and there, Rebecca should have known that conflict was coming, because in that culture, it was very much appropriate that the older was the headship of the siblings, not the younger. And so it would go against everything that culture knew, and it would go against the children, and it was certain to cause problems. Warren Wiersbe, who wrote a commentary on the Old Testament, notes that the fact that God had already determined to give the covenant blessings to Jacob didn't absolve anybody in the family from their obligations to the Lord. They were all responsible for their actions, because divine sovereignty doesn't destroy human responsibility. In fact, knowing that we're chosen of God means we have greater responsibility to do His will. And I think that's a really important point to note here, was even though Rebecca knew that Jacob was going to eventually be the head of the family, didn't make it right what she did. And I think we can think about that too for ourselves. Just because we know that maybe this is what's supposed to happen doesn't mean the way we get there is right, is not sinful. So that's the first precipitating event. The second was that there was just favoritism between parents. Now, I know that no parents, you're not supposed to have favorite children or anything like that. But even if you do, you certainly shouldn't tell them that. And yet it was very clear that Isaac loved Esau and Rebekah loved Jacob. And that would later encourage Rebekah aiding Jacob in deceiving her husband and her other son. And that was going to be a problem. Third, Jacob steals Esau's birthright. This happens in Genesis chapter 25. The birthright was maybe even, if you think in terms of money and power, maybe even more important than the blessing, because the birthright meant headship of the family, it meant double portion of the wealth, and it meant that that's where the covenant blessing would come through. So remember that God told Abraham that he would make his descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand and the sea. Well, if you're talking about a genealogy list, the covenant blessing was supposed to go through Esau. When we look at those genealogies in the Gospels, Esau was supposed to be listed, not Jacob. And yet Jacob, being kind of the conniving guy he was at home cooking a bowl of stew, and Esau comes home from a hunt, and he's starving. And he says, give me some stew. And Jacob says, sure, sell me your birthright. And Esau, who, as we're learning, very impetuous, reactionary guy, says, I'm going to die. What does it matter anyways? Like that, he sells everything. And as soon as that first spoonful goes in his mouth, I think he realized what he did. And he was angry, and he says he despised his birthright. So Jacob stole from Esau once, setting up for a second time. Fourthly, Esau decides to marry foreign women, which was not appropriate to who they were, and so it antagonized Rebecca. So already she loved Jacob more. Now Esau was doing things to get under her skin, so why not get her back a little bit? Again, the point of all of this is that conflict never comes out of nowhere. There are always events that precipitate it. And for us today, I think it's really important when we consider conflict in our own lives that we recognize those things that happen to lead up to where we are at. And we need to do that in order to successfully consider what reconciliation means, because it might not mean just dealing with what happened now, but it might mean dealing with what happened back there. So, reconciliation is a journey to conflict, but maybe even more difficult, it's a journey through conflict. Sir Walter Scott wrote famously in his epic poem, Marmion, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." This was never more true than when Jacob deceived Isaac, because it didn't just involve him, it involved his mother. And the consequences didn't just involve his brother, it involved his father, and it would involve the generations to come. When Rebecca and Jacob's dishonesty came to light, the fallout was really astounding. Jacob moves to Haran to live with Laban. In Rebecca's mind, it was going to be a couple months, marry someone, come back 20 plus years later before he ever saw Esau again. And Rebecca would die before that happened. She would never see her son, her beloved Jacob, again, and she would never see Esau and Jacob reconcile. And Jacob would eventually move near Isaac shortly before Isaac died. And there Jacob and Esau would reunite again and see each other one final time for the funeral. So how did they journey through this conflict? For Jacob, I think part of it was that he got a taste of his own medicine. If you know anything more about his story, he moves with his uncle Laban, and he sees one of his Laban's daughters, and he falls in love with her. And it's very strange for us today to talk about family marrying family like that. It was very normal in the Bible, but I wouldn't encourage it. But he sees the daughter, and she's beautiful, and Laban makes him work for her for 7 years. And on their wedding night, sends the daughter in, and he thinks it's the right one, but no, it was the older, kind of less attractive sister. So he has to work another 7 years. So 14 years that Jacob works to get these two wives, getting a little taste of his own deceptive medicine. For Esau, we don't really know what changed his heart, except maybe time away. And in reality, I think all of us, the best thing we can do in conflict sometimes is just to take a step back and breathe and really think about our own selves. And maybe Esau came to terms with his own role and what was stolen from him, because his life afterwards, it says that he prospered. So the journey through conflict took some lessons on their parts and took time. So reconciliation is a journey. Second, it is an encounter. Letterock talks about it being specifically an encounter with God. How does God encounter us in conflict? So Jacob and Esau haven't seen each other for decades, and now they're going to meet. And the night before Jacob was to meet Esau, and he hears that Esau's coming with 400 men, and he's freaking out. And he goes by himself to the river, and this unknown assailant begins wrestling with him, and it turns out to be God. Jacob encountered and wrestled with God, and I think it was symbolic of his whole life, this constant wrestling with what God wanted him to do versus him doing it himself. And Jacob prevails, and in this encounter is named Israel, meaning because he wrestled with God and man and won. After dealing with God, what else then did he have to fear? It was from here that Jacob went out to meet Esau. So reconciliation is our encounters with God in conflict. Finally, reconciliation is a place. Specifically, it is a time and place in which we meet our enemies, in which we recognize the encounters we had along the way with God, and that we notice and name these things happening inside of ourselves. In Genesis 33, they finally meet after decades of not seeing each other. They have wives and children and servants and gold and livestock. And for Jacob, he approached this meeting with a lot of fear and trepidation. The day before, before he wrestled with God, he sent his servants to Esau with all this stuff, like bribing him. I don't know, maybe he felt bad about what he did and wanted to give him a peace offering. And now as he approaches Esau, he sends ahead his children and his wives and his servants. Maybe as a gesture to soften Esau's heart, maybe because he was a coward and didn't want to go first. And then he bows to Esau 7 times as a sign of respect. And Esau, surprising everybody, sprints to Jacob, throws his arm around him, hugs him, kisses him, and they weep. And Genesis 33:8-11 records this. And he, meaning Esau, said, "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" And he said, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." Jacob said, "No, please. If now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one who sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." He then urged him, and he took it. So at this place, the brothers meet. Seeing how God had favorably treated them both, even though one had had things stolen from him and one had stolen things. Esau's murderous intents have long since passed, and he weeps at the opportunity to see his brother again. And on Jacob, he gives Esau's gifts as a gesture of what God has blessed him with over time. Both had journeyed to conflict. Both had journeyed through conflict. Both had encountered God in some way, shape, or form, and now there was the place of reconciliation. And they, during that time, had been able to see the parts of themselves that were good and the parts of themselves that had played in the conflict, and presumably had seen the parts of their enemy that were good as well as those that played in the conflict, and both saw God's presence over both of them. Now, what did this reconciliation mean for them? In the church, we often talk about forgiveness, but it's very rare we talk about reconciliation. And forgiveness and reconciliation, I think, are very different things. Forgiveness is very much a part of reconciliation, but it really only requires one person. I have to be the one to forgive you, regardless of whether you change, regardless of whether you you accept it. It's all on me to do so. Reconciliation takes both parties coming together. In this case, Jacob and Esau had time to forgive one another in their own hearts before they reconciled. But let's be honest, this story doesn't end happily ever after. Jacob and Esau meet in this place. Esau goes home. Jacob says, "I will follow you there," and then he doesn't. We don't exactly know why, and they meet one more time. And that's at their father's death. They didn't get to raise their children together or their grandchildren together. They didn't get to share in holidays or have parties celebrating big events. They saw each other 2 more times in their lives. So what can we learn from this story about reconciliation? We need to evaluate ourselves in conflict and determine what role we might have played, recognizing that nobody is ever fully innocent. Second, we need to understand the ways in which we respond to conflict. Are we reactionary? Do we avoid? Do we do both sometimes? And instead of turning towards whatever may feel most comfortable for us, we might instead need to turn towards journeying to and through the conflict, even if it means going places we don't want to go. Third, we need to recognize the ways in which God encounters us and our enemies in conflict and follow where God leads. Fourth, we need to look at those with whom we are in conflict through the eyes of God. Truly, I think that makes a difference if we see people as our enemies or if we see them as God sees them. And fifth, I think we need to recognize that reconciliation is a messy process and it doesn't always have a neat ending tied up with a bow. Only when we journey through conflict and invite God into that journey can we really experience reconciliation. And as Paul calls us as a church to be ambassadors of reconciliation, we might have to go on that journey a lot, maybe our whole lives even. As conflict continues to escalate in our country over politics, over race, over ideologies, as terrorism continues to exist in the world and threaten all of us, whose only response to terrorism, the world, is violence on violence, can we learn to teach the world to see others through the eyes of God? As churches continue to splinter over the ways that they view God and practice things differently, can we attempt to journey together through conflict, seeing one another as God sees us? As we experience interpersonal conflict in our families, in our workplaces, with neighbors, with friends, in our own churches, can we commit to journeying together to reconciliation, even if it makes us uncomfortable, even if it makes us take an uncomfortable look at ourselves? Can we ask God to be with us on this journey as we continue to discover what it means to be ambassadors of reconciliation? Let's pray. Father God, sometimes I look around at this world and I don't understand why we do what we do, except that I know that this is what a world who is not turning towards God looks like. Sin has caused us to enter into all kinds of conflicts, to enter into violence, to enter into anger, to reject one another. And God, as a church, as people of your faith, we are not free from that on our own. It's only in you that we are free from that, God. And so I pray that you give us your spirit and help us learn what it means to be reconcilers in the midst of conflict. God, we thank you for Jesus, who was the ultimate reconciler when he went to the cross and he reconciled us to you, bridging that sin gap. God, I thank you for what Jesus has done for us, and I pray that we might live in his light. It's in his name we pray all these things. Amen. I invite the worship team forward to lead us in a response.